Wednesday, June 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. is set to unveil new security assistance for Ukraine as Russia attacks intensify.
As we approach the 100th day of Russia's war against Ukraine, we remain concerned about steps Russia is taking to attempt to institutionalize control over sovereign Ukrainian territory, particularly in Ukraine's Kherson region.
Tensions over the Aegean Sea continues to escalate, with Turkey and Greece accusing each other of violating their airspace.
Early this month, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis no longer exists in the Turkish leader's mind.
And Nepali search and rescue teams recover bodies of 22 people aboard a small plane that crashed in the Himalayas. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said at a press briefing on Tuesday that the Biden administration will give details of potential new security assistance for Ukraine, quote, before too long, unquote. He added that Washington also remains concerned over Russian attempts to institutionalize its control over Ukrainian territory it has seized, including the city of Kherson.
As we approach the 100th day of Russia's war against Ukraine, we remain concerned about steps Russia is taking to attempt to institutionalize control over sovereign Ukrainian territory, particularly in Ukraine's Kherson region. The Kremlin is probably weighing a few approaches, from recognizing a so-called People's Republic, as Russia forcibly did in Donetsk and Luhansk, to an attempted annexation, just as Russia did in Crimea. In Kherson specifically, multiple reports indicate Russian forces have forcibly removed legitimate Ukrainian government officials and installed illegitimate pro-Russian proxies. Russia has also forced Kherson residents to adopt the Russian ruble over the legitimate Ukrainian currency, according to multiple accounts. As of late April, Russia likely controlled at least 25 broadcasting towers in Ukrainian areas under Russian military control, including in the Kherson region, and was airing pro-Russia media channels, probably to weaken anti-Russian sentiment and public resistance. The Kremlin probably views that forcibly holding Kherson would provide Russia a land bridge to Crimea, as well as gaining some kind of so-called victory, an attempt to justify Russia to Russia's domestic audiences, thousands of lives Putin's war of choice has destroyed.
That's State Department spokesperson Ned Price. Russian forces, in a, quote, frenzied push, unquote, have seized half of the eastern Ukrainian city of Severodonetsk that is key to Moscow's efforts to quickly complete the capture of the industrial Donbas region. The city's mayor also told the Associated Press today, in his words, the city is essentially being destroyed ruthlessly, block by block, unquote. Reporter Anna Chenikova in Kyiv updates VOA's Steve Radish.
About 50% of the city was captured by Russian troops as of now. He said, I'll quote, Russian troops control a large part of the city of Severodonetsk. Fighting is taking place in the central part of the city. The first Russian assault was unsuccessful. They were pushed out of the city by Ukrainian forces. The second assault was successful and they managed to consolidate and create a certain bridgehead. Geographically, along the perimeter, the assault took place in three directions, end of quote. What we also should mention that for the moment, the city is paralyzed due to the fightings, very intensive fightings. It was not possible to deliver any humanitarian aid to the civilians for about a week now. And also, any evacuations are happening for a couple of days now. The shelling and fighting took place 24/7. The General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine announced that Russian troops are focusing almost all their efforts on establishing control over the city of Severodonetsk. So basically, we can see that most of Russian fresh forces and the best equipment they have for the moment are concentrated in this area.
Are there other places where Russian forces seem to be making progress?
No, for the moment. What we can see if we look generally at the front line, really most of their forces are concentrated in Donetsk and Luhansk regions, and in particular Luhansk region for this point of time, the city of Severodonetsk. If we look at Kherson in the south, they control certain territory and they control the city of Kherson, but they are just defending there, so no actions, advancing actions. Even more in Kherson region, we, for the past couple of days, see the advance of Ukrainian soldiers and Ukrainian army. There are destructions in the north, so Russian forces continue to shell Sumy and Chernihiv region, as well as in the east, the city of Kharkiv and Kharkiv region, but there is no particular advance and any actions except of shelling.
What can you tell us about Russia's claim to have found the bodies of 152 Ukrainian soldiers in that steel plant in Mariupol that held out against Russia's attacks?
For the moment, we don't have official information or official calls from the Ukrainian side, because this is the city of Mariupol for the moment is totally under Russian control.
That's reporter Anna Zhenikova speaking with VOA Steve Radish from Kyiv. China has fallen short of its bold plan for 10 Pacific nations to endorse a sweeping agreement covering everything from security to fisheries. Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with key foreign ministers from the 10 small Pacific nations, but no agreement was reached despite the hype that followed the announcement of the tour as part of China's effort to expand its influence in the Indo-Pacific. Analysts expressed surprise that Beijing was not able to seal the deal. For more, I spoke with Robert Sutter, professor of practice of international affairs at the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs.
The Chinese are being hasty here. If you look at the pattern of Chinese expansionism throughout the region, and particularly in the Pacific Islands, it's a steady, incremental process. Big, dramatic things like this that are risky are rare. And so this was a departure. It was this secret deal and dramatic effort. Now, here's a couple of things that I'm thinking about. The opposition to this in public has come notably from the head of the Federated States of Micronesia. It strikes me that this suggests there are real holes in the Chinese support in the region. The second thing that doesn't get enough attention is that the Australians, the New Zealanders, and particularly Japan have a lot of influence with these Pacific Island countries. The Chinese, maybe they're on thin ice. Maybe they really don't have a lot, and therefore they dramatic move to consolidate their relationships.
Analysts often talk about China's growing influence in military, economic, and even diplomatic affairs. Now that this deal has fallen through, has that blunted that assessment of China?
Well, I think it should. I wish the coverage that we're seeing on this would start pointing out a whole bunch of weaknesses that the Chinese have in this part of the world. They're not that powerful in this part of the world. I do think that the Western Aligned countries do need to organize together, but they're already doing that. The Quad meeting had a resolution, as I remember, that talked about giving the countries of the region the capacity to monitor fishing fleets. You start monitoring fishing fleets in the Pacific Islands, what will you see? You'll see enormous intrusions by Chinese fishermen against your interests. The fact that it didn't pass the muster with these leaders is a reflection of the traditional, independent-minded Pacific Island countries. That's a very good sign.
How do you think Washington should respond? Others are saying Washington should get credit for talking in the background diplomatically with some of these countries and strengthening them to stand up against China.
I think that's part of it. I think the U.S. does have to pay more attention to the region. But keep in mind, and I think this is obvious in the situation, but it doesn't get much attention, this is an issue that binds the United States very closely with Australia and New Zealand, who have a much bigger stake in this area, and Japan, which has a big stake in this area. And so it can be a very much collective effort on their part. I was really impressed by the Federated States of Micronesia standing up to the Chinese after they were wooed by the Chinese so strongly 2 years ago.
That's Robert Sutter, professor of practice of international affairs at the George Washington University Elliott School of International Affairs. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Zhao Liyang told a regular press briefing on Tuesday that China is strongly dissatisfied with and firmly opposed to U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth's visit to Taiwan. During the visit on Tuesday, Taiwan President Tsai Ing-wen said the U.S. is planning on, quote, cooperation, unquote, between its National Guard and Taiwan military, deepening security ties in the face of what Taipei's government complains is a rising threat from China. China's military said last week it had recently conducted an exercise around Taiwan as a solemn warning against its collusion with the United States. That came after U.S. President Joe Biden angered China by appearing to signal a change in U.S. policy of, quote, strategic ambiguity, unquote, on Taiwan by saying the United States would get involved militarily if China were to attack the island. U.S. officials said there had been no change in policy. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, said on Tuesday that the United States will again push for more UN sanctions on North Korea if it carries out a seventh nuclear test, despite opposition by China and Russia. China and Russia last week vetoed a U.S.-led push to impose more U.N. sanctions on North Korea over its renewed ballistic missile launches. They publicly split with the U.N. Security Council for the first time since it started punishing Pyongyang in 2006. Thomas Greenfield warned that North Korea is, quote, actively preparing to conduct a nuclear test, unquote. If that happens, she said on Tuesday, the United States, quote, absolutely will push again for more U.N. sanctions on Pyongyang.
We absolutely will. First of all, we need to enforce the sanctions that we have already authority to enforce. And we certainly, as we attempted in this last resolution, will push for additional sanctions.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Tensions over the Aegean Sea continue to escalate, with Turkey and Greece accusing each other's warplanes of violating their airspace. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The sea is a center of contested territorial rights. Early this month, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis no longer exists in the Turkish leader's mind, after Mitsotakis called on the U.S. Congress to block military sales to Turkey. Ankara is alarmed by Greece's rearmament program, which Turkey claims is being deployed on islands close to Turkey. Mesut Çarşın is an advisor to the Turkish president.
They buy $5 million combat aircraft from French and new cruisers, and also almost $10 million for helicopters, naval forces, and also new F-35. That time, that's what happening? What happening in the Greek Isles? Will they decide to attack Turkey?
Greece's rearmament comes as the U.S. Congress blocks Turkey's efforts to procure weapons from the United States out of concern over Ankara's purchase of a Russian missile system. Analysts say Ankara is worried about the changing balance of power between the two countries. Serhat Güvenç is a professor of international relations at Kardahas University in Istanbul.
Turkey was denied modern military hardware for a number of reasons, whereas, you know, increased access to such weaponry, and this will, of course, tilt the military situation in Greece's favor.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu ratcheted up tensions Tuesday, warning that Turkey is ready to challenge the sovereignty of Greek islands and accusing Athens of violating an international treaty stipulating they remain demilitarized. But Greece insists it's acting in self-defense. Athens is voicing concern that Turkey could open up its borders to let refugees enter Greece, as well as step up military pressure over its islands in the Aegean Sea. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
In other news, Nepalese search and rescue teams on Tuesday recovered the body of at least 22 people aboard a small plane that crashed in the Himalayas 2 days earlier, and also found the flight's recorder. 2 Germans, 4 Indians and 60 Nepalese were on the De Havilland Canada DHC-6-300 twin otter aircraft. It crashed 15 minutes after taking off from the tourist town of Pokhara, 80 miles west of Kathmandu, on Sunday. The plane was bound for Jomsom, a popular tourist and pilgrimage site 50 miles northwest of Pokhara, on what should have been a 20-minute flight. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. 2 days after Sudanese military leader General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan lifted the state of emergency on Sunday and released political detainees, street protests have continued. Anti-coup activists are still demanding a civilian-run government, as they have since the October 2021 military coup. What is the way forward? Are most civilians and international community open to negotiations? Sudanese political analyst Jihad Mashmoun tells VOA's Carol Van Dam there have been signs of compromise from all sides.
That does seem encouraging in creating an environment for dialogue between both sides, the military and the civilian opposition. In the same instance, I'm inclined to say that it's too early to determine the intention of the military component and how the civilian opposition will interact with it.
Does it open the door to negotiations with the international community about the way forward? Or is it impossible to envision, you know, a military-run government being sustainable for any lengthy period of time, the way things are?
Now, the international community has always been focusing since the military coup of October 25th of October 2021. The international community has always been focusing on a civil-military partnership. Every time you say we would like a civilian-led democracy, that means that the military is going to be involved in it. Now, here I have to emphasize that the civilian, people in the streets, especially the resistance committee, they've been against any partnership with the military. So what happened, in essence, within this long protest that happened, is that the UN and the African Union, you got it, formed a triadular between three different organizations to lead the dialogue process. There are currently indirect negotiations between the civilians and the opposition. At the same instance, the people are still protesting at the streets and they're being led by the resistance committees. These are the real mobilizers of the street at the moment. The international community, if it really wants to help Sudan, it can actually help Sudan by imposing a warning to the military to improve the situation further. And by warning, I mean specifically mention targeted sanctions against the military component or those who are obstructing the dialogue process. Both sides have to compromise, the military and the civilian opposition.
Right. And when you talk about that, how do you envision that compromise being played out?
The civilians need to understand that this dialogue is a way of trying to understand what the military wants to achieve. Does it want to stay in power? Is Lieutenant General Burhan al-Hammadi, they're avoiding the inquiry to what happened to the emptying of the protest side of 2019? Or are they protecting the former regime or certain groups within the former regime? That's what the civilians need to focus on. And the military on their side, they can improve the environment that's happening in Sudan, such as allowing the people to continue to protest, provided, of course, the process ensure that the security of the people protesting. And by ensuring security, I mean that ensuring that no one is harmed.
That's researcher and political analyst Jihad Mashamoon, who is also a research fellow at the Institute of Arabic and Islamic Studies in Exeter, England, speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam. The United Nations and humanitarian agencies warned on Tuesday that there is, quote, concrete risk, unquote, that a fifth consecutive rainy season could fail in East Africa, leaving millions of people facing severe hunger. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Across East Africa, suffering its worst drought in four decades, millions are in need of rain. But on Tuesday, the United Nations and humanitarian agencies warned that such prayers may well go unanswered. Four consecutive rainy seasons have failed, they said in a joint statement, with the March to May season appearing to be the driest on record. That's exacerbating a hunger crisis that could see 20 million people facing acute food insecurity by September. Forecasts also indicate, the statement said, that there is a concrete risk that a fifth rainy season from October to December will also fail. Claire Nullis, spokesperson for the World Meteorological Organization, told a briefing in Geneva that the threat of starvation looms in East Africa. "We are particularly concerned that the situation is set to get worse," she said. Millions of livestock have died in Ethiopia, Kenya and Somalia, according to the statement. And over a million people have been displaced in Somalia and southern Ethiopia. Aid agencies are seeking to avoid the repeat of a famine a decade ago that killed hundreds of thousands of people. The statement said a rapid scaling up of actions is needed now to save lives and avert starvation and death.
This is Science in a Minute.
The B612 Foundation's Asteroid Institute says it is now using a new technique on ATOM, its cloud-based platform, to discover and track asteroids. The new technique is actually an algorithm called THOR, Tracklet-less Heliocentric Orbit Recovery, that was developed by researchers at the University of Washington in Seattle. The Minor Planet Center, part of the International Astronomical Union, confirms that 104 asteroids recently found with the Asteroid Institute's augmented program have been added to its registry. The ATOM platform, with its Thor algorithm, discovered the group of asteroids by digging through the NOAA Lab Source Catalog, which is a grouping of about 68 billion observations gathered by the telescopes of the National Optical Astronomy Observatory between 2012 and 2019. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including President Joe Biden meets with the Federal Reserve chair to discuss the state of the American and global economy, and the president's top economic priority, inflation. We'll discuss this topic and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
To all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and television programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinua Ruafo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In advance of the May meeting of the World Health Assembly, the WHA, which is the decision-making body of the World Health Organization, the WHO, Secretary of State Antony Blinken strongly advocated for Taiwan to be allowed to participate as an observer and lend its expertise to the solution-seeking discussions. For most of the past 50 years, Taiwan participated robustly in certain UN specialized agencies where statehood is not a requirement. Recently, however, its engagement in these fora has been constrained. In a written statement, Secretary Blinken noted that today's unprecedented health threats demand close international cooperation. The annual meeting of the World Health Assembly is an opportunity, he said, to drive cooperation towards ending the acute phase of the COVID-19 pandemic and advancing global health and global health security. Inviting Taiwan to attend the WHA as an observer would exemplify the WHO's commitment to an inclusive approach to international health cooperation and health for all. At a press briefing, State Department spokesperson Ned Price pointed out that Taiwan's expertise and approaches in the realm of global health and beyond that realm as well can benefit the world. He noted that the WHO broke years of precedent at the 70th World Health Assembly in 2017 when it failed to invite a Taiwanese delegation to attend as an observer, a failure that has been maintained every year since then. As we continue to battle a pandemic, as we continue to confront other public health threats, Taiwan's isolation from the world's preeminent global health forum itself represents a serious health concern, spokesperson Price said. We believe that Taiwan's significant public health expertise, its technical and technological capabilities, its democratic governance, its resilience in the face of COVID-19, and its robust economy offer considerable resources to inform the WHA's deliberations, and we believe there is no reasonable justification to exclude its participation. Secretary Blinken declared that the United States will continue to support Taiwan's membership in international organizations where statehood is not a requirement and encourage Taiwan's meaningful participation in organizations where its membership is not possible, in line with our One China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communiques, and the Six Assurances.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.